good afternoon, and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink. Laron Landis has today off. Where's Laron today?
Do we know? No clue.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wasn't listening either. Laron, we love you. We weren't listening. And our guest today is the wonderful Rollins Gilliland. You probably know him from that other nonprofit station. You know, he was telling me about how much money he raised during their pledge drives. We have a pledge drive coming up. We need you to come and
help.
Well,
I've done pledge drives on KNON for my friend Reed, who has a show on Tuesday night. So
awesome. Well, if you remember Rollins from KERA, what you'll remember is if you were to say, and he hasn't been on for about 2 years now, but if you were to think back, name a story you heard on KERA over the last month. The story that you'll remember would have been Rollins, because they were just beautifully told. They were interesting. They were different. They were not things you heard anywhere else, and that's who he is.
That's what I think is such a craft. I mean, you really have a craft of storytelling.
Well, that's very nice of you to say.
That is amazing. And a lot of people can't do that. I mean, they really can't. So they can't tell a joke. They can't. You know, that kind of stuff. But you really
How did you learn?
I can't do my taxes myself on QuickBooks either. So we all have our knacks, I guess.
Yeah, I always have somebody else do mine, too. You have till tomorrow this year. How did you learn storytelling? Just natural?
Well, I'm a seventh generation Texan. And I believe that storytelling in Texas is a huge part of the lore. I mean, I never stopped and analyzed it, but my dad's father, without getting long-winded about it, but my dad was the youngest. My dad was the youngest of a big family, and his father had been 50 when he was born, and my dad was 40 when I was born. So I was born in 45. So bottom line is that I grew up talking to my 100-year-old grandfather, who had been born 5-10 years before the Civil War ended. Believe he was orphaned in the Civil War at 8, and you know, and he had gone to work at like 14, I think, on the Chisholm Trail, and had many tales to tell. And then my father had left home at 16, which would have been I guess in 1932, to go on the road in the big band era, and ultimately played with Benny Goodman and so forth and so on. So my father would tell me stories like about what it was like to be having a drink between sets with Billie Holiday. And he would describe, you know, and he wasn't being condescending. It wasn't like Perez Hilton or something, but he would describe how there were the underarm stains under her white satin gown. I mean, he was noticing everything. He told me about when he watched Greta Garbo in 1925 walk across the ballroom at the Hotel del Coronado, you know, beach and hotel, and that he noticed her ankles were very thick. You never saw that in movies. I mean, it was always details, you know, and my grandfather would be the same way. Sam Bass had been a notorious outlaw of the day, and he had met Sam Bass, and he was describing the entire thing. So it's a long answer to your question, but I never stopped and thought about it. But I just think that that has a lot to do with how you kind of grow up fleshing out what you've observed. And also, I think I've inherited a pretty incredibly good memory.
It takes all those things, but it takes a real talent to be able to put those together well.
My mother was extremely good with the language, and again, it was very organic. She was brilliant and beautiful and smart. She had 2 master's degrees at like 20, had been raised in money, you know, got disinherited when she eloped with my father, you know. But anyway, but the thing is that mother, one of the reasons that I got exposed to early feminism was that when I would ask mother about something, she wouldn't just tell me what she thought. She would explain why. And that enabled me then, you know, there's 2 sexes. Of course, these days we're like now getting to where we're saying there's like 28. But, you know, whatever. I thought, you know what, I'm a man, and so I can learn about being a man. But it was really an inside-the-looking-glass glimpse into women, listening to that. Everything about the world I was exposed to growing up was about stories.
Well, talking about stories, you told me one before you got here, Patty. You were in Oaklawn. You heard some people talking, and they asked you, "Oh, have you ever been to Istanbul?"
Yeah, that's
I love
that's
this story.
I'm very charmed actually that you would ask me to tell that story, because it's kind of a good example of how I'm kind of, without trying to be, I don't mean this in a strident doctrinaire way, but I'm old enough to have remembered before the gay culture created itself. Mm-hmm. I was living in San Francisco in the early 70s, do that math. As I told you, you know, I knew Harvey Milk after they opened Castro Camera. I mean, it was a very small world then, but particularly, you know, his partner Scott. But anyway, so I've never had a lot of connective tissue to the end quote, air quote, gay community. I mean, I'm openly gay and, you know, but you know what I'm at. So I was at a party, a very charming party, guys, and I'm in a high rise there at Fairmont and Turtle Creek or something. And there's all these gay men, you know, and I hadn't been at one of those parties in a long time. So anyway, they're all sitting around and they've all been on these various cruises and everything to Istanbul. And they were all talking about it, and they were talking about the best places to get the shoes and all these other things. And I was just sitting there listening. And finally, they turned, one of the guys did. Everybody was probably about 50. It's a middle-aged crowd. Mm-hmm. And not a woman there. It's just, you know, that one of those. And they turned to me and said, "Well, you haven't said anything. Have you ever been to Istanbul?" And I said, "Well, yes, actually, I lived in Istanbul." And they said, "Well, why didn't you say anything?" I said, "Well, my experience with Istanbul is very different." And they said, "Well, how?" And I said, "Well, in 1973, I stowed away on a nonstop Lufthansa flight from L.A. to Amsterdam and then took the train to Istanbul, and I was flat broke. And I'm living in the youth hostel, and I realized all these guys are horny. They want to try to find where the brothels are. I, being raised by a flaming feminist who really believed that prostitution should be legal, but only if women were in control, actually went to the brothels and introduced myself. In fact, I actually let them line up. I chose the woman I'm going to be with. I went with her. And then when I did, of course, we did nothing, and I talked to her. I wanted to know about her thing. And she said, "Why don't more men like you come here?" And blah, blah, blah. And I said, "Well, I can arrange that." Anyway, to fast forward the story, I got introduced to the women who were controlling this thing, and I made a deal with them. They said, you know, that they would pay me commissions for bringing the men. And I said I'd bet them, because, you know, I don't want these loser jerks showing up. No entitled men allowed. And then I went back to the youth hostel, and I started then abetting the guys. So I became a double agent pimp in Istanbul. The guys are paying me to go to the thing. I even had my own taxi driver who would turn the lights off and go the back ways and everything so that no one would ever know where we'd been. And for 9 months, I raked in the money being a double agent pimp in Istanbul. Well, the minute I finished that story, if they had been wearing pearls, they would have been holding them. And there was total silence, and after the silence, then somebody stood up and went, "Well, what about, does anybody need any more?" There was never any alluding to the story I told. There was never any follow-up reaction. It was just, "We're right back to canapes and Prosecco." So, you know, I stuck.
And not one of the stories you heard on the other station.
Probably. And in fact, as I was leaving the house, Aaron said, "You tell David he needs to have his finger on the button with Brock."
Even in my shows, and by the way, all three of my shows, stage shows I did, I always made sure that they were all 18 and over, but I don't use profanity. I don't make vulgar. I'm not into that wink, wink, double entendre, innuendo, mm-hmm. gay, you know, wink, wink, you know, campy stuff. And I'm never vulgar or graphic. Mm-mm. So you don't need to worry about the button. But I can tell you, I can tell you right now, they probably wouldn't have me on KURA telling about how I was a double agent pimp in Istanbul.
Oh, gosh, no.
I'm almost sure during a fundraiser that might clamp down on the... What, but it'll work here.
On
so
this
I'll,
station works.
Yeah. So bring me back and I'll say, you know.
It just works here.
Thank you.
Yesterday, let's just bring it up to yesterday. You performed a wedding in front of a mural of yourself in Deep Ellum.
Well, that was a lovely experience, I must say.
It sounded like it, yeah.
It's two women. The woman I'd known, she was my service advisor for my Toyota, my Scion XB. I met her like 10 years ago. And Shelley doesn't like very many people, but she liked me, and she trusted me, and she told me, you know, I'm in love with this woman, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, fast forward, she asked me to marry him, and then she wanted to be married at this in front of this 16-foot mural of my head that muralist Steve Hunter did from a photograph by John Turtlemaz, who does a lot of the covers of The Observer. He's the one that photographed all the programs, posters, and cards for my string of stage shows, one-man shows. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the last show that I did, yeah, it was this one, mm-hmm. the one last year about 70 years of poor conduct. What he had me put a black eye on, and I was photographed shirtless in the bathroom at Lee Harvey's, and that was the poster. And so the muralist decided to do this. He got a big commission, and he did a 16-foot mural of my head down in Deep Ellum, which actually looks just like me. I mean, it's like photorealism one eye. I mean, mm-hmm. I've had kids walk up to it and go, well, that's you. And I feel, I really look better than that, don't I? You know, not with a black eye and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, that was how I ended up. And it's right next to Reno's Bike Bar. Mm-hmm. You know, it's on mm-hmm. Crowdus at Elm. And at 6 o'clock, yeah. So and then what was so wonderful too, and what I love so much about 2016, and also the way we as LBGT people, you know, have a much broader world out there that, you know, supports us. The photographer Turk came back and did the photography for the wedding. The muralist Steve Hunter and his wife was there.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, because these people, I mean, they loved the idea, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, so we're lucky that we lived long enough to see 2016. And then, of course, I'm doing the wedding, and I made it very personal, and I talked about, you know, and I choked up when I was doing it.
Did you ever imagine, back when you were stowing away on airplanes, and we'll get to that, but did you ever imagine then that you'd be performing weddings for a lesbian couple one day?
In Texas.
In Dallas. Dallas is my hometown in Texas. Well, you know what? Of course not. And last year, one of the weirdest things, and again, it was the weirdest thing, I went over to JR's on lunch to, you know, I'm a consultant to the Dallas Market Center, and, you know, I mean, we have mm-hmm. to pay bills, and I love them. And I went to, I knew that the Supreme Court, I bet everybody's forgotten. Oh, my God, I'd almost forgotten that the Supreme Court last year at the end of June,
marriage,
you know,
equality
ruled on same-sex marriage. Well, it just so happened that the very day, which was a Thursday, that was announced, is when the Observer, Dallas Observer, dropped with me on the cover reclining in my own fish pond in a red Prada suit.
That's quite a
cover.
Photograph.
And
that's
quite a cover. But that was the issue that dropped that day on the same. So I'm over in Oakland looking at those Observer kiosks with that image while I'm sitting there drinking to something. I hate to be emotional, but I mean,
it is emotional.
That we all really, really worked to see happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, only 2 weeks ago I got to be there for the reception, you know, when Patty and Aaron were married, and look at the people that were there. And I don't know. See, I give these ridiculous long answers to very simple questions.
And see, but that's the great thing
and
about your
that was a problem on KERA sometimes. Long answers to what you,
but yeah, I mean, you know, it's like And I was having a pretty – I'd had a pretty rough week, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I'd had a really rough week. I mean, you know, things happen in our lives, you know. I had to euthanize my beautiful 12-year-old dog that I've loved so long. I mean, things happen in life. And it wasn't an easy week for me. And so – but I remember last night standing there right before that wedding started, and I thought, you know, be in the moment. And I've always done this, but, I mean, I was having to remind myself again. Photograph this in your mind. Mm-hmm. Be here now. Because, really, even though this has been a complicated week emotionally for you, for a variety of reasons, to be honest, you're standing in front of a 16-foot mural of your head in your hometown, and you are legally marrying two women. And you... The two people responsible for this mural are these two wonderful men that I'm lucky to call really dear friends. Mm-hmm. They're both really wonderful family men, heterosexual male friends of mine, and artists who are half my age. There's a thousand reasons why that was an amazing experience.
It sounded like it. We need to take a break. We're talking to Rollins Gilliland. He is Dallas's premier storyteller.
Exactly.
On-air storyteller. So we'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
This is Jason Wright from Dallas, and I listen to Lambda Week 89.3 K.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink. And our guest is Rollins Gilliland, the wonderful storyteller. And we're just telling stories today because we can.
I like your attitude.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a dreary day out there.
Yeah, it's a good day for wonderful stories. You know, when you were talking just now about how emotional marriage was, I'm taking this ethics class at our synagogue, and they came up with this, the textbook we're using had this really insipid story about marriage, and it was terrible. And which side should you be on if, you know, and what should you say if you don't think the bride is the most beautiful, blah, blah, blah.
Who cares?
And exactly. That was my point. And I
that
said,
sounds like Trump.
You know what? I said, now I get it. When they say we've redefined marriage the way it's been since biblical time, if that's an example, I'm glad we did. I said, on Marriage Equality Day, I was down at the courthouse. I was in tears. I saw some of the most beautiful couples getting married. It had nothing to do with the way they looked. It had to do with how beautiful the day was. And to me, that was, you know, so when you say you got emotional performing this wedding.
I remember when the night that President Obama was elected in 2008, the very first time, you'll like this story. I live on a very mixed race neighborhood. It's about a third black, third white, third brown, basically. And I've lived there 33 years. But at the time, I'd lived there, 25? And I filled my wheelbarrow up with ice and loaded it with ice-down bottles of Prosecco and put on a tuxedo, and I rolled from house to house to my black neighbors to... See, I get very much to serve champagne. You've got to make note of these moments.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, you absolutely do. That's what was so incredible about me when I'm sitting there at JR's and people are honking horns and going down the street and juxtaposed in front of it, it's me on the cover of The Observer in the red seat. See what I mean? It's like let me back up a second. I've met a lot of people who don't really pay true attention to the nuance of the moment. The times in which they live, the moment. A second tier to that argument is they're the people who almost go to things. They almost did certain things. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other subject. But it's touching to me because I'm here with you and Patty, and God knows, I know that none of you were reclining on a hammock reading back issues of Red Book and just thinking, well, that's nice. You know, you were deeply there when that happened, and I'd like to think that's true for me.
And you know what I think is really amazing is I think that living in the moment is a really important thing, because that's That's the living. That's the living of it.
It absolutely is. And again, if you're going to take this into an analogy, think of the people you go to a concert now. I was just one at the Granada the other night, and they had their phone up like this the whole time videoing it. So in between the actual thing and their face is this thing videoing it. And I'm thinking,
just enjoy the concert.
she's not at this concert. She's planning to be at this concert when she watches this video anyway.
Which she'll fast forward through anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's just a crazy time, but to let go. I remember that night so well when President Obama was then president-elect. Yeah. And that moment, I'm going to tear up too, that moment when they announced that Senator Barack Obama is the next president.
I think it's when Ohio and Pennsylvania went down.
And Aaron and I had gone down to Bishop Arts, and the Democratic local Democratic Party had reserved the entire street.
And
there were jumbo screens. And just I hugged and danced with people. I didn't even know.
And see, I ended up at that Brooklyn Jazz Club down on South Lamar that was there, and I was the only white person in there. But see, there were a lot of black people in that bar who were blasé about what was going on. They weren't even watching the screen.
See, no, at Bishop Arts, because I was there too, you know, I was excited, and I don't usually say how I vote, but I guess 8 years later it doesn't matter. But I was excited that he won, and then I was standing next to some African-American people, and they were in tears. I got it, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, I'm excited, but I can't even begin to understand how they're feeling.
Well, and I think that's an understandable thing. Mm-hmm. I was very disappointed, though, with a lot of the people when I was down at the jazz club, because I think a lot of the people were younger, and I didn't mention Barack Obama about political. I would think that very much I would have – I mean, of course I did, but the truth of the matter is, no matter where you stood on that, you know – whether or not that was who you voted for or not, the bottom line is that you would be absolutely stupid and not realize that this was certainly not something you expected to live long enough to see if you were born in 1945 like I was. My God, my parents were involved in civil rights when I was a kid. I mean, in 1953, I remember she was Democratic precinct chairman, and I remember being down there and very often, I mean, you know, going to homes in State Thomas, you know, and then canvassing in the part of town because mother spoke Spanish fluently anyway. I mean, there's a lot of history there. And then, you know, so you've got to make note of the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You do. And I remember kind of an opposite moment when the Lawrence v. Texas decision came down from the Supreme Court. And Aaron and I have told the story a number of times. But when that happened, we were all prepared to meet at the parking lot of the Resource Center to do, like, at 5 o'clock, whatever day it happens.
Yeah,
let's be there at 5 o'clock. And we were going to do a press conference. Of course, all the media came, and we had, like, 5 different press releases. We took every permutation of what they could rule, and were ready. And we had this great press conference, and people were there and just cheering and stuff. And we went around to the to JR's. And Aaron and I went up and spoke with people because some of the TV stations had put cameras on top of, like, at that time, Hunky's, which is now something else now, across the street, on the roof, to kind of, like, to record the dancing in the streets. And there was none. And you know, because they were clueless. And so we went through JR's talking about, you know, isn't this a great thing? And so many of these LGBT people who are our peers in the community had no clue that 2106 even existed.
You know what? I was going through this last week. And again, this has nothing to do with Hillary Clinton, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'll be first to tell you I like Hillary Clinton. But that's not the point. My mother's mother was the first tenured woman professor at the University of Texas. She got her doctorate in 1922. She fought for the vote. My mother, you know, was a flaming feminist and, you know, really a wonderful role model. And so, you know, all of these things make a difference. And yet I was and I have many, many friends that I have very few friends that are peers my age group. Through my work with KURA, I developed an audience that was pretty much both, you know, abroad. If you had been at my shows at the Kessler, for instance, it was all ages. And I imagine the amount of LGBT people that were there was about the percentage that exists in the greater society. It would be like seven, you know, whatever. It was just, it's not a niche. So anyway, most of my friends are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe 50s, but a large portion in their 20s and 30s. And very naturally. But I was with two women last weekend for hours, actually. And one was 30, one was 31, and they see themselves properly, I think, as sort of new age feminists. But they obviously had gone and had academic, you know, female studies, academic, blah, blah, blah. And I've spoken at Texas Woman's, and that's my mother's alma mater. So I really understand this sort of, you know, we're pro-woman by being at a male sort of sidebar to a lot of the new feminism. And I really was shocked when I was hearing, I don't know how relevant this is to what we're talking about, but I was personally enormously shocked when they were making fun of Gloria Steinem. I understand that she had offended maybe somebody recently, but I said, Gloria Steinem in 1970 was the co-founder of Ms. Magazine. You know, I mean, you don't have to like Gloria Steinem. You don't have to blah, blah, blah. But you should read her book that came out last year. It's very interesting. I reread The Feminine Mystique. You might not think that that's Betty Friedan's book that, you know, was from about 1960, whatever, about the sort of Stepford wife educated, you know, thing that went in Connecticut. My point being this. I don't understand this sort of current wave of sort of a disengagement from the context of the times that other people lived in. Mm-hmm. It's
bizarre.
It is. Because, I mean, for instance, like, you know, I told you earlier, I turned 21 on the witness stand as the sole witness at a murder trial, and all of a sudden I was on trial for being gay in Dallas in 1965. How can I not then think, well, that sort of makes, you know, marrying two lesbians at, you see, but I said, don't you understand that, yes, Gloria Steinem is now 76 years old or something. Barbara Streisand is like 74. I met Barbara Streisand in San Francisco when she was 27 and gorgeous. I think there's people that don't realize she was once young and beautiful, you know. Am I making any sense?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
There's just this disconnect from sort of how one day at a time. I said to these young women who were both very intelligent and everything, but they said, you know, we dismiss these people. I mean, you know, look at what Hillary and all these other people, you know, but it's irrelevant to us today. And I said, yes, and I've heard that at the Martin Luther King Center when I've spoken from young people about MLK. I mean, you know, come on.
I think they don't realize that maybe in Texas in 1964, and every day prior to that, a woman in this state couldn't have a bank account, have a credit card.
My sister tells me.
Couldn't own property in her own name.
Oh, absolutely. No, my sister in the 70s had to get her husband's signature in order to buy property. The point is this.
I don't want
people to think they're defined by the past, but I don't want them to forget that there are shoulders upon which they stand, and that's a critical difference. Like I say, I'm not defined by being gay, but I'm also not.
I think a lot of people, a lot of younger people especially, well, even people our age who don't pay as much attention, once we got marriage equality, okay, that's it. And they're not understanding, well, where did this come from in Mississippi and North Carolina all of a sudden?
Absolutely.
Well, it's the backlash to that.
Oh, sure.
Well, what about the blasé thing about the HIV? I mean, you know, they think it's, I've talked to you. I mean, I volunteered at the Resource Center at one point to be I've got what do you do where I got
counselor or
I got vetted or whatever to be a same sex, you know, counselor. I'm not a same sex, but a safe sex counselor. And everybody the young ones kept trying to get me to tell them how to have unprotected sex and not get infected. I said, I feel like I'm at Weight Watchers and everybody's wanting me to tell them how to eat donuts and not gain. I don't know. It's like they're just this.
It is a complete disconnect.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I must have this, let's work around it.
You know, so you buried all your friends from college in San Francisco and New York in the 80s and 90s. But you know what? How did that relate to me? Well, you know, I kind of think it does.
Mm-hmm. We've had that discussion on this show before about
the
blasé attitude of young people about HIV and about the need to protect themselves still, you know?
But don't get me wrong. I really believe that all young people should be looking at things through fresh eyes, mm-hmm. but they should also understand then in their rearview mirror that one day at a time connectivity. When I was a little boy, my grandmother that I discussed, she made me read the story of every female pioneer in the cause, you know, all the Margaret Sanger, all of them. Mm-hmm. And they dated back to like the 1880s. And I said to these two women the other night, you don't think that something that this woman did in the 1880s is relevant to you? You don't think that one step at a time?
Do you know what Margaret Sanger's connection to Dallas was?
No.
Do you know Ripley Shirts? It's a custom shirt maker in Oak Cliff.
Yeah.
They were very involved in birth control for whatever reason.
Yeah, well, that was.
And what they would do is they would send shirts in shirt boxes up to Margaret Sanger in New York, and she would return those boxes filled with condoms to be distributed here in Dallas.
Wow. Then? I wonder what year that was.
I don't know, but it wasn't even legal to sell condoms at the time here in Texas.
Well, we just had a whole discussion in the last week or so about Ted Cruz and his whole dildo problem, you know, which I think is fascinating, too, because that's as archaic as the not being able to sell condoms.
Right.
In this.
You've got to be modern and you've got to be young, no matter, because we're all living in the now. I mean, I'm living in the now, but I've also lived in those nows.
Okay, so in those nows, you turned 21 and spent your birthday on the witness stand.
Yes.
Tell us about it. It's a story.
It's a great story.
It was the second story in my first show, and unfortunately, I can't help it, but it blindsided a bunch of people because it was an anomaly to a lot of the other stories. But I wasn't on. I thought when I did that show, it was going to be the only show I ever did when I first did it at Sons of Herman, and then that whole thing took on a life of its own. But here's what happened, basically. I took a job stalking the North Park Neiman Marcus and you know, I was in college, but, you know, at night, you know, you're stocking because they haven't opened North Park. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it's being built and it was stocked. And so it was real late at night. It was like after midnight, and I was driving toward Oaklawn because there was this all-night diner. And, you know, and it was starting to mist, and it was like 31 degrees, and they were saying it's going to freeze, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, to fast-forward the story without ruining it, really, I ended up seeing something that, and a lot of this I just kind of had to reconstruct in my mind because I know what happened, but I don't quite remember, you know, as you would understand exactly what I saw or what made me do this. But I saw something that made me stop my car with the idea. Remember, there's no way that anyone could have communicated if they had car trouble or if they'd gone off the road or something. And what ended up happening is that I inadvertently ended up walking upon, as I went through the thing, upon a gang rape murder. It was four guys from North Dallas. It turned out to be affluent, from good families, good schools. You get the drill. Mm-hmm. But I witnessed that, and I almost got away, but I didn't. My car skidded, and I got taken hostage. I don't remember how I got transported, but we ended up at the end of Cochrane Chapel Road, which is right off of Midway, but just south of it, at the end of the cul-de-sac. And I was left for dead the following morning, face down, naked, and had been gang raped in frozen mud. I mean, I remember when I got up. I really wasn't badly wounded, actually. There was one guy that had been pulling his punches, but there's a lot of nuance to this story. But the thing is, I remember when I pulled up after I saw they were going away, and I could hear the cracking as I pulled my face up out of the ice. One thing led to another. I fast forward the story. I was able to identify them in a lineup. They got caught with some stuff they had stolen from my car. And Dallas was a smaller town then. So anyway, I ended up becoming the sole witness to this murder trial of four affluent guys that were 19 and I was 20. And Actually, this is a good punchline. Do I have time for the punchline?
Yes.
Because I don't know how we're doing on time.
Yeah, we have a minute.
I'm on the witness stand, and all of a sudden I realize the very first question that the prosecutor is asking me is, Mr. Gilliland, never mind, this is a murder trial. He said, Mr. Gilliland, do you know the definition of fellatio? I was just stunned. And I said, well, yes. And he said, will you turn to the jury and tell the jury what fellatio is? And I turned to the jury and I said, fellatio is a pasta larger than linguine but smaller than lasagna.
That is awesome.
And we need to take a break.
Wow.
We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
This is Kimberly Truex of the GLBT Wedding Expo, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink. Lauren will be back with us next week. Our guest is Rollins Gilliland. He's telling us stories. Just before the break, we were just saying, and I missed part of that, before the break, you were the witness in a murder trial.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the victims of these people. But you don't know exactly what happened to all of them.
No, I really don't. Because as I explained in my show, the first show, I testified for 2 days. And it was very interesting, just for the record. I'm in this trial at the same time that all the people that were involved in the Kennedy assassination were. That would have been Police Chief Jesse Curry, Head of Homicide Will Fritz, the District Attorney Henry Wade. So it was very interesting, on top of everything else, aside from the horror of it, that I was actually dealing firsthand with all these people while the whole Warren Commission thing was going on. But yeah, after I testified those 2 days, and basically I was on trial for being gay, because here's what they did. This is how they came up with their defense. I had witnessed this. I'd been taken hostage, like I said, and left for dead and blah, blah, blah. But what they ended up, they absolutely could not claim that I had not been their victim because I'd identified them. So what they decided to do was completely claim that they had nothing to do with that gang rape and the murder, but the whole story begins with the interaction with us. And they claimed that I was at a red light going west on Northwest Highway at Inwood, and that they were over to my left, and that I made homosexual advances to them at a red light, and that they were so outraged that they ran me off the road, and even though it was wrong, it was understandable that they were so outraged that they stripped off all my clothes and beat me and left me for dead. Mm-hmm. You know,
see,
basically.
It's like gay panic on steroids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was kind of like where they were going to come up with this thing. And then they were saying that anything about, you know, what happened as far as this woman and her male companion and everything was just like some invention on my part that had nothing to do with them. So, yeah, I actually tried to get two different times I tried to really get like the transcript of what happened, mm-hmm. but I really honestly did come to realize I frankly don't want to know. I'd like to leave it at that, mm-hmm. because I just guess you can see why.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I lived long enough that story became, you were telling me, David, about when you were interviewing this guy who had done a hate crime, mm-hmm. and he's been in prison for 5 years and blah, blah, blah. I'd be willing to bet that of the four guys, I know one of them, the one that actually I saw cut the throat of the man. I know he was a sociopath. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a psychopath. I mean, that guy was like probably never going to be anything but a monster. But I know that the other three guys were just under his spell and young and they never intended to be part of a murder, and they probably never intended to be. I mean, I don't want to go off base here about mm-hmm. telling you about each individual one, but when for 4, 5, 6 hours I was face-to-face one at a time with them while they would torture me, I made eye contact with all of them, and mm-hmm. I could read their different souls. I don't want to sound like Bush saying he read Putin's soul, mm-hmm. but, you know, they said to me, how can you be positive to identify them? I said, I looked into their eyes when they were thinking about killing me for 5 hours. I don't think that's real hard to identify. They can change their hair and change their clothes and clean up, but they can't change their eyes. Mm-hmm. So those guys are probably fine men now. You know, mm-hmm. what do I know?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yes, it's like, it really does.
I was talking to a guy, you know, not long ago, and he said, you know, I can't still be, you know, he had been bullied in high school. And he said, I can't still be mad at 53 with the guys that were 14.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I lived long enough that story really actually was something. I said my last line when I told that story online, if I remember, was, although no one will ever envy you having, you know, had this, I'm paraphrasing, this monstrous experience, make note that it suggests that your life is interesting and that this happened to you as an adult and you can process it as an adult, mm-hmm. and that someday it will be something that a story you find interesting to tell. And I lived long enough to actually be, you know, 50 years later telling it on stage. And I felt I felt much less emotional telling that story on stage than I would like when I was recounting marrying those women last night or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not blasé about it at all, but I'm not the one that's ever going to say I'll never get over it, you know?
Right. You've given it a context within your life.
Yeah.
And it's obviously not going to control you.
No, absolutely
not.
It hasn't. Not, absolutely not. And it was very definitely a fascinating experience. I said, you know, it was a fascinating experience. It's like we were talking about. You know, this guy might be have done this horrible thing and blah, 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 but nothing is simple. This is what I'm having problem when I'm talking with people, especially people about history and context and everything. Nothing is black and white simple. You know, I mean, over here, yes, that was the most monstrous thing that could possibly happen. And, you know, who in the world, you know, but over here, it was damn interesting. It was a damn interesting
experience. It's
that Chinese
proverb thing, too. It's like, may your life be interesting.
It's damn interesting to have been the sole witness at a murder trial at 20.
Yeah.
You met George Wallace, the governor.
Yes.
But you met him toward the end of his life.
Yeah.
And you didn't meet this horrible monster.
Well, I met the man who had been the horrible monster.
But
David's alluding to how I ended up by a fluke in 1976 winning a grant. They called it the Master Poet Grant. It was National Endowment for the Arts. They changed the name. I was profiled in D Magazine, and I love Peter Semmick, but he really, really came down hard on me about me saying it was a Master Poet Grant because there's no record of that. But see, they ended up changing that because there was a lot of objection, the word master in the Deep South coming to connote, you know,
right.
slave, blah, blah, blah. So they've erased all that. But anyway, the grant had to be matched by state. Ohio, Nevada, and Alabama matched it. I didn't want to go to Ohio. Who would? I didn't want to be a poet in residence in Nevada. Why would I? So I ended up going to Alabama. Anyway, fast forward the story. I'm at a big, huge opening of a massive plant that's going to be making physical ed equipment for Sears, which at the time was the Walmart of its day. And they have George Wallace on the stage, the governor, and his then-wife Cornelia. This is what makes this story interesting, even though, you know, that's not what you were really alluding to. The day this happened, which was, I think, the 7th or the 9th of September 1976, was the very morning that the news story had broken about his wife Cornelia having bugged his bedroom. He was, you know, a paraplegic at that time. He'd been shot, you know, several years earlier when he was running for president. And by the way, he was a Democratic president.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, governor. I'm always quick to remind people that, you know, think, you know, everybody on my camp's a virgin. But what happened is that I was the poet in residence, and I'm supposed to be off stage and just say maybe 30, 45 seconds of something before they really get to the meat of the matter and somebody introduces the governor. Well, all of a sudden then, the governor and his wife are hating each other. Can you imagine? This news story is broken. In fact, I'd heard it on the Today Show. And so they're hating. So Governor Wallace goes, who's that boy? I was 31 years old or something. Who's that boy? And they said, bring him up here. And they had him put a chair between me and Cornelia, his wife Cornelia.
Oh, demilitarized zone.
Yes,
totally.
Exactly. And I'm I've only been poet in residence maybe 5 days there. I've never even been to Alabama. Now I'm master poet and everything, and I'm sitting next to George Wallace, and I was raised by flaming activists for civil rights. And, I mean, it's an out-of-body experience you couldn't have. But in any case, he would not address anybody. And in between things, and when they were doing things, he would engage me a little bit. And finally, he told me that if I was in Montgomery, which was like maybe 100 miles away or something, and I would be, he gave me the contact of who you contact and everything. And so I took him up on that, and I think it was two, maybe three times I went and saw him there. And he was a very broken man. He had come to realize, I really think in his heart, none of this negates any of the monstrous things he did, believe me. But again, it's about context. He had lost the governorship the first time, you know, and then he said, I'll never be out end again. And, you know, and it was a racist thing. And he ended up, he became a very... The poster child for racism, and he realized really honestly, I do believe in my heart of hearts that he intrinsically, that had never really been who he was, but it's who he became. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And now he was a broken man. His life, you know, his first wife Lurleen had been the love of his life. His second marriage, you can see where it was going, and I realized talking to him, this man. He really realized that if he had done the right thing, he would be... I think he was interested in his legacy, you know, and instead of it being that he's remembered as the monster poster child, he could have been remembered for something better. Mm-hmm. So part of it was his self-importance, you know, I mean, but part of it was also very touching and nuanced, and I did feel sorry for him, and I felt privileged for the thing. But none of this even begins to mitigate the truth. Mm-hmm. But I do know this, that even when I tried to write a piece for KURA about that, called The Man, the Poet Who Knew George Wallace, there was a lot of pushback because we live in a time where people are either good or bad. Mm-hmm. There's no, you know.
Right.
And I said, you know, remember what I told you earlier? There was LBJ sent all my buddies from high school to Vietnam, and 30 of them came back in body bags, but he also was the one that pushed more civil rights legislation through than all the other presidents combined. How do you reconcile that? Mm-hmm. There's this big debate right now about Thomas Jefferson. Oh, he had slaves. Oh, well, so all of a sudden, Thomas Jefferson, nothing. Remember what Kennedy said at a big dinner at the White House when he was president? He said... That he was talking about the Nobel laureates, and he said this room is right now collectively full of the most impressive minds who have ever sat in this room, with the sole exception of when Thomas Jefferson was here alone. I paraphrased
that.
But now all of a sudden it's going to be,
terrible person.
It is nuanced. I mean, our world is full of nuance.
Black and white, trap door.
Yep. Okay, we're kind of running out of time, but we can't let one thing pass. You kind of, when I moved back to San Francisco and was living in the nude commune.
The nude commune was actually north of San Francisco, but I lived in San Francisco from 71. I actually stowed away on a New York to Honolulu flight when I was living in Central Park in the Rambles area, where every night there was very nice sexual activity. But that's where I was actually living, and I ended up there, and I ended up in San Francisco. So I lived there for 2 years. This is before Harvey and them opened. I think they opened Castro Camera in 74. And then lived in a new commune north of San Francisco. But yeah, I was there the entire time. The gay.
There has to be a story about the nude commune.
Well, the nude commune's many stories. I actually lived in a treehouse in the nude commune to boot.
Whoa.
You know, I built a treehouse, and everybody thought, well, he's so uppity. It's kind of the way, you know, like if you're living in a high rise over in Oklahoma, they're thinking, well, I'm still down on the ground, you know. It's like, but I was just entrepreneurial enough, I built a treehouse at the thing. But yeah, I loved it because there were three orgies a day.
Oh, my God.
There was a 1:30 and there was an 8:00, and you know, and it was the counterculture. This is not a gay commune. This is the counterculture. Mm-hmm. And being bisexual was considered sort of in at that moment, and I thought, well, that is a trend I can build on, you know? So I'm here to try to help these men be trendy. So,
And he was successful.
Yeah, but I would go, you know, but I'd be in my treehouse, and I'd be reading, and I'd think, well, you know, should I go to the 1:30 orgy? I think I'll wait for the 8 o'clock orgy. But the orgy... You know, I'd have to. It's a lot more to explain about how that was done. It was actually a resort spa. You know, with geysers, mm-hmm. In the time of Teddy Roosevelt, early 1900s, and it had been destroyed in the same earthquake mm-hmm. that destroyed San Francisco in 1906. So as a result, there were still these pools with hot water mm-hmm. coming up and all that kind of thing, but it was like it looked like something out of Mad Max. You know, and meanwhile, a lot of the people there were draft dodgers. It was definitely that mm-hmm. era and stuff like that. And I ended up there, and I lived there. And even when I came back from San Francisco, I mean, from Europe and Istanbul and everything, I ultimately lived up there.
Okay, so again, not one of the stories that he told on KERA.
Right.
No, but I told him in my shows. That's why I had nobody under 18 coming. But as you see, I mean, you know, they were never vulgar. But mm-hmm. but you know what? Something funny, and I hope I can get this point sure. in. I said in the shows, and it was true, that going to those orgies actually is how I got over that body image that you have as you're a rape victim. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of encouraging people in a way, you know, if you've been raped and you've got bad body image, consider orgies, because, you know, everybody at an orgy is going to think, you know what? Yeah. And I had a nice body, but I had this bad, mm-hmm. ugly body image, as you do, you know, when you've been raped. So I don't mean to be flip about it, but it was the most unusual way to spiritually heal from something you hadn't really completely dealt with.
Okay, we have 1 minute. How do you stow away on an airplane back in 1960s or 70s?
Actually, I'd never be able to tell that in one, but there wasn't just one way. Every time I did it, it was different.
We need a whole show, I'm telling you, David.
But it's the truth. Sometimes it would be simply me bribing someone. Or one time I remember paying somebody, and I put on I changed into one of those, you know, everybody smoked, and there'd be the people that came on when you'd lay over. If it was a New York to Washington to Dallas flight, well, there'd be people came in and swept the floor. Mm-hmm. I'd put on that uniform and go in and sweep and then take that off, and I'd know that the thing wasn't sold. So there'll be empty seats. That'd be one I could tell in a minute, but some of them are very long and involved. I mean, getting on a nonstop internationally from New York, I mean, from L.A. to Amsterdam was, I had to check if the statute of limitations was up on that one. But I never killed anybody or did anything awful in order to get on a plane.
I want to thank you. This has been an interesting hour. Actually, it was a wonderful hour.
Well, y'all are delightful people.
Come back, see us again.
And I'm very grateful to y'all, because you know what? You're really contributing very organically and sweetly and meaningfully to the cause that matters and all. And that's just that we're seen as just like everybody else, trying to have a good time, be solvent, and party and sleep and love.
And our guest next week is Wesley. I can't think of her last name. She wrote a book about being a mom of a gay son.